Hey, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, it's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Which means opposition to it all. And interviews with journalists and other writers. This mic is too low, got me slouching. Up. So hey, welcome to it. Yeah, I'm Scott Horton here on the Liberty Radio Network, live noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, on the weekdays. Host Anti-War Radio on KPFK on Sunday mornings, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. And you find all my interview archives at scotthorton.org, more than 3,500 of them now going back to 2003, scotthorton.org. And, oh, you could do like I forgot to do, but I'm doing right now. You can join up the chat room. Just put in a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. Blam. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. Had a couple of new guys in there yesterday, I think. Good to see new people hanging out, especially, and sometimes when the old ones come back. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. I hope you hate cops, because that's a lot of what I tweet about. I'd hate to hurt your little feelings. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Scott Horton Show on Twitter. You can find it. Okay, cool. So today on the show, we've got some interviews coming up. So this guy, Jonathan Marshall, I don't know who he is, but he wrote this article and I thought it was good. It's about Egypt. Obama's Egypt policy breeds terrorism. Yeah, you don't say. Jonathan Marshall. He'll be on here in a little while to talk about that. And then our friend Mike Meharry returns to the show. He's from the 10th Amendment Center, from offnow.org and other things along those lines. And he is using the power of state nullification and interposition to try to put a halt to some of the worst of the national government's policies. And the Michaels over there, Meharry and Bolden, they sure set a good example for political activism in this country, I think. The 10th Amendment Center. They'll be on to talk about that. And then, you might remember, right around a year ago, I interviewed this guy, Waleed Farwana. And what happened was he had written this gigantic thing. I think that maybe he had first sent to Justin Raimondo to take a look at. And it was kind of a history of the rise of the Islamic State. Who are these kooks and where they come from and how to get to be the way it is right now. And it was really good. And it was, you know, one of these 7,000-word jobs. And we ran as a spotlight on antiwar.com, which is something that we hardly ever do, run an article that's that long. But in this case, it was really worth it. And I really liked it. And I think I did a whole hour-long interview with him about it because there was so much to it. Well, so now he's got a new one. And this was actually by request. Somebody asked me on Twitter, you know, what exactly is the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran? And I said, you know, I don't know, but I know somebody who knows a lot about this stuff. Let me ask this guy what he has to say about it. So he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll write a giant 7,000-word thing all about it for you. And then he did. I don't know how many thousand words, but quite a few. And it's really good. It's at his blog, lateempire.com. What a great name for a blog, huh? Late Empire. And it's published in three parts. God's Revolution, The Advent of Hezbollah. And so, yeah, there you go. How it was that Hezbollah came to be. What is their relationship with Iran? Etc., etc. So that's all interesting stuff. And, you know, I understand it's a very politically charged topic of conversation right now, which is why the guy was asking in the first place. And this article actually starts out with, man, it's kind of hard to ever find this subject addressed by anyone other than a bunch of propagandists for one side or the other. So, How about somebody who doesn't have an axe to grind, just explaining as best he can what it is that's going on here? And so that's what he's done. God's Revolution, Part 1, 2, and 3 on the creation of Hezbollah. Yeah. So Waleed, he'll be on the show today as well. Cool. All right, now what time is it? Oh, man, I got to hurry. Spent too much time talking about that, and I got to talk about this. I didn't get a chance to discuss this on the show yesterday, but seems pretty important. Former top brass to Netanyahu. Accept Iran accord as done deal. Israel must renew trust with the United States. Quote, initiate political move in support of the two-state solution. Dozens of former Israeli defense officials say in an open letter. This is from Haaretz, the liberal Tel Aviv daily. And they published an open letter here, recognizing that the P5+1 agreement with Iran, the agreement, is an accomplished fact. We, the undersigned, urge the Israeli government to adopt certain policies in light thereof as follows. And what they're saying is, oh, and then, man, the signed, it's dozens, it's scores of retired generals, Mossad officials, leaders of Shin Bet, which is their FBI, basically, their internal national police force, security, internal security force. Oh, and also rules over the West Bank, too. It depends on whether you call that internal or external in occupied territories. You know what I mean? But anyway, scores of these guys. Many, many, many of the leading national security professionals in Israel are... And look, you can tell what their thing is. First of all, the Iran deal ain't that freaking bad. And secondly, you're going to break Israel's relationship with America over this? Knock it off. In fact, it's very short. Here's what it says. Renew the trust. We demand Netanyahu renew the trust between and enhance the political and security cooperation with the U.S. administration in order to prepare for the challenges emanating from the agreement, including formation of procedures for monitoring. All right. In other words, let's get in on this thing. Intelligence cooperation for monitoring, preparing for relevant action to be taken in the event of a breach, intelligence coordination. So there, you know, if we're going to be able to bust Iran for cheating or even have a chance to, we're going to have to be cooperating with the Americans on this, don't you think, Mr. Netanyahu? And of course, Netanyahu's thinking, well, Obama's going to be gone. It's going to be Hillary or Jeb, and he can deal with them much easier. I don't know how much easier. I mean, it's not like Obama's been that bad of a problem for him or anything, but on a personal level, anyway. Anyway, they're just saying, and then two, they're saying, give up the West Bank. Or at least initiate a political move which will provide credibility to Israel's support of a two-state solution. So in other words, back to the peace process pretension that at least we're trying to negotiate a Palestinian state. Because, of course, Netanyahu's politics are, you know, ultimately suicidal for the state of Israel. He must be a crazy person. He must be nearsighted. So there he is being corrected there. Something important. You know, in America you have the Republicans saying, oh no, this is like selling out the Jews to the Nazis at Auschwitz. Right? Mike Huckabee saying this is, putting the Israelis and, you know, marching them up to the oven door. Oh, really? I wonder why so many Israeli generals and Mossad officers and former leaders of Shin Bet support it. I guess because they're stupid and suicidal and pro-Nazi and pro-genocide against Jews, huh? Is that it? Or the Republicans are completely full of it. Maybe that's the problem. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I like this song. It's too bad it's over already. Almost. I like those guys, man. All right, it's Turbo Negro, in case you're wondering. That one is called Armed and Fairly Well Equipped. All right, so yeah, now listen here, man. Barack Obama, you know, I just really ain't like that guy very much. Never did. Here's the thing about him. Yeah, he's a liar. He's been lying about Iran all along. Boy, I got in trouble one time on, I was on RT. And I said, Barack Obama is a liar. Iran is not in violation of their international obligations whatsoever, other than a bunch of UN Security Council resolutions, but they're not in violation of the treaty, and he knows that, and he's just trying to make you believe things that aren't true. And it was Alana, what's her name, was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe he called the president a liar on the TV show. Yeah, well, only because he's lying. And same thing now, him and John Kerry have decided the only way we're going to get this deal through is we got to tell the people our only choice is either this deal or war. Well, that just plays into the whole narrative of just how dangerous Iran is, and maybe we need a war with them. If they're that dangerous, you sure you want to do a deal that gives them nukes? Because that's what I heard the deal is to give them nukes. Why would you do that, Barack Obama? Say the confused people who listen to right-wing talking points all day. I'm confused. You're saying we need to have a war, a nuclear war with these guys? What? When in fact the truth is, Iran's nuclear program is a civilian safeguarded electricity program, medical isotope program, and it always has been. They've never enriched any weapons-grade uranium. They stopped any experiments along the lines of pursuing nuclear weapons back in 2003, and in fact, you know, really even those experiments never amounted to a nuclear weapons program at all. It was just, you know, a few scientists here or there in different government departments pursuing small projects on their own, but nothing that amounted to a nuclear weapons program. And that was over 12 years ago, and the CIA and the Israeli Mossad agree about that. That's not even in dispute from the leaders of the war party. They're within the Non-Proliferation Treaty. All this deal does is extra super verify. Even Bill Kristol, leader of the American side of the war party, tweeted out that they're giving up something they never had in exchange for all this money. Well, yeah, only because they scaremongered everybody into pretending like this was such a big deal in the first place. So, we've gone from a safeguarded nuclear program to a double extra super happy lucky wish nuclear program. I'm sorry, I'm sure you're sick of hearing me say that, but I don't know how else to say it other than with superlative Japanese adjectives there, a poor translation model. The choice is not this deal or war. The choice is either this deal or the same old safeguards agreement they always had. The same old signature to the non-proliferation treaty they always had. The same old report from the IAEA five times a year, whatever, four times a year when it comes out. The agency has continued to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. The negative has again been proved. We know they haven't diverted any of their uranium because it's all still here, proving it's not somewhere else. Again. That's the truth. Oh, you better pass this deal or else we'll have to have a war to stop them from making nuclear weapons. Oh, man. All they're doing is handing ammo to the war party. You know, it could be said from a very cynical point of view that Obama doesn't even want this deal. Obama's trying to blow up his own stupid deal with these stupid lies. And that, but to check off the, hey, we tried negotiations, but they didn't work, you know, box off the list before the war. They got to go through this. Although, except, no, that's not plausible because look who's screwing up the deal. The Americans. Everybody else is for it. And I don't know if the Republicans and the other traitors in the Senate and the House will be able to stop the deal or not. I think they probably won't. But, you know, Obama's basically sabotaging his own deal with this ridiculous narrative that his deal is the only thing preventing war. Now, it's true that, I don't know, if the deal falls apart, the Americans won't go along with the deal, keep all the sanctions, whatever, whatever. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the Iranians have been smart this whole time to say, look, our hands are up. We're within the non-proliferation treaty. We're within our safeguards agreement. We're not making nuclear weapons, and so leave us alone. Don't bomb us. So far, it's worked. Now, this deal was to put the issue to bed, supposedly. But it doesn't necessarily mean war. And I don't think that there's better than a couple of percent chance that the Ayatollah would decide to pursue nuclear weapons unless the Americans had already attacked them and attempted to destroy their nuclear program, in which case, at that point, they, you know, may well decide they have no choice but to actually make nukes in order to deter future attacks. The only way to make sure that there's no nuclear program of any kind in Iran is to invade and occupy the place. That's it. Even George Bush recognized toward the end of his presidency that if there was going to be a deal with Iran, that it would have to recognize their right to enrich nuclear material. Their right to a nuclear program under, you know, provided the safeguards are extensive enough. Well, that's what this deal is. That's why scores of Israeli generals and intelligence officers and, you know, counterintelligence officers are supporting the deal. And also, you know, because they're worried about Netanyahu jeopardizing Israel's relationship with the United States, which they're wholly dependent on. You know, so they can get away with their war crimes in the West Bank. They need superpower support for that. And man, I'm so sorry. I'm out of time. I got three interviews coming up and no time to discuss any of the rest of this. You got Palestine, where protesters, two Palestinians, have been killed protesting against the arson killing, price tag attack, killing of the 18-month-old baby in the West Bank. There's this great article that I can't believe made the Washington Post op-ed page. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Israel wrecked my home. Now it wants my land. A blind man and his family. This is where your tax dollars go. And then, there's the music. Oh, and then Israel expands detention without charges to citizens, citing, quote, Jewish terror. But you see what's going on here. In the name of the price tag attack, they're changing the law so that now Israeli Arabs, that is Palestinian Israeli citizens, will be able to be held without charges the way the people in the West Bank are. So subtle and clever. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up.
And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm here. I know. Music's fading now. I'm getting my ear goggles on here. All right, on the line, I've got Jonathan Marshall. He's been writing, at least a thing or two here at Consortium News. .com, and a page down past his bio, unfortunately. Here we go. Independent researcher from California, and quite a few articles here for consortiumnews.com. Welcome to the show, Jonathan. How are you?
Thank you very much. Doing fine. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Now, I read this article, and I thought, you don't say, but actually it did kind of ring a little bit familiar. There's been a Crystal Kagan split, actually. Unbelievably, on the issue of Egypt ever since, I think, 2011, whether to support the rise of the democratically elected rise of the Muslim Brotherhood or military junta to replace them again. And so now you've got this article about talk about a broken clock getting it right. A letter signed by Robert Kagan and Elliot Abrams? Really? Along with Reuel Marc Gerecht, and I don't know who Ellen Bork is. But anyway, those three are pretty hardcore neoconservatives. And they sound just like a Democrat or a Libertarian or something on Egypt, confronting the Obama administration for supporting this military coup and pressing them to press the government of Egypt to back off of their police state repression. Really?
That's right. I can usually count, you know, going in blindfolded on any issue, I'll disagree with them, usually pretty vehemently. So I was pretty stunned myself to see that they had written a letter that I agreed basically word for word with.
Yeah, I mean, especially Elliot Abrams. I mean, anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just for the benefit of your listeners, in case you didn't preview this, their letter to Secretary of State Kerry, who is now, or just a day or two ago, was in Cairo, was asking him to press the case very hard with the military-backed regime in Egypt to really promote human rights. And not just to pay lip service, as we usually do, but in the deeper interests of our own national security, because supporting the government while it throws thousands of opponents in jail, throws journalists into jail, disappears journalists the way they used to in Argentina under the military regime, and so on, is turning Egypt into a breeding ground for Islamist terrorism. I mean, not surprisingly. And the stakes are huge in Egypt, given that it's one of the most populous countries in the Middle East and signatory to the Camp David Accords and so on. So this kind of repression is likely to blow up in not only Egypt's face, but our face. And instead, unfortunately, the Obama administration has been so intent on trying to curry favor with the regime. It's resumed arms shipments, training, all sorts of collaboration. And in past months, the State Department, even or Kerry, was saying in public statements, oh, the regime is moving forward nicely on human rights. Well, human rights organizations have put the lie to that. The State Department's most recent human rights report put the lie to that. And these signers, not all of whom were neoconservatives, but as you mentioned, three of the leading lights in the neoconservative movement signed it, are saying, hey, this is really bad policy, time for a change.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too. People should know that this is not, you know, and take a look at the article. You'll see that this is not some very superficial, oh, wow, you know, Bill Kristol's buddy said something that sounds sort of kind of like something that I said one time, but in some other horrible, twisted pro-war context or something. It's really not like that. I mean, they're really saying the very, you know, like, you know, intelligent analysis here that if we completely ban, more or less, relatively speaking, moderate Islamist political participation, then we force them to be radicals. In other words, just like I've been saying since 2011, is Zawahiri is watching right now, and he's getting ready to shout his "I told you so." When that was his thing all along, is that the Muslim Brotherhood were a bunch of sellouts for participating in Western power schemes and democracy and the laws of man and all this stuff, when the Americans would never let you win. They'll take it from you anyway if you did win. Watch. And then as soon as they win, that's exactly what happens. America and Saudi come and do a military coup, and it was predictable enough, and I only found out, I think sometime earlier this year, that in fact Zawahiri did put out a podcast in the summer of 2013 saying, "See, I told you so. A real Islamist fights for Al-Qaeda. Never mind trying to participate in, you know, the political process." And so the Muslim Brotherhood, who are basically a bunch of old, rich Republican conservatives, get displaced and replaced by, displaced by the military coup, but replaced by a bunch of radical young bin Ladenites who, you know, are what's left after the old conservatives' humiliation here.
Yeah, the Muslim Brotherhood has had a peaceful strategy of winning through superior organization, and ultimately they were able to take advantage in the most proper way of the kind of democratic opportunities offered by the Arab Spring. And they won fair and square. I think a lot of observers would agree that the government under Morsi was not particularly inclusive. He alienated a lot of people by trying to centralize power in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is kind of not very surprising given Egypt's lack of democratic tradition. But nonetheless, the way to get rid of him was through the ballot box, not through a coup. And so the young Turks in the Muslim Brotherhood are tired of getting thrown in jail and being told by their elders that they should stay peaceful. And naturally, the siren call of ISIS and other radical groups, Al-Qaeda, are very, very strong in Egypt right now. And when you think about it, Egypt's economy is very easy to disrupt through terrorism. It's very heavily dependent on tourism. A few bombs placed in Cairo or at some of the major tourist sites would keep American and European tourists away from the country and dramatically reduce the country's balance of payments, and things could go downhill very fast. So I think it's interesting. Maybe I'll quote a couple of the sentences from this open letter that they wrote.
Go ahead.
Regarding, following the resumption of arms shipments to the regime of the new president, Al-Sisi, who seized power in 2013, they said, "State violence, several thousand killed during street demonstrations, tens of thousands of political prisoners, hundreds of documented cases of torture or forced disappearance, sexual assault of detainees or family members, reported collective punishment of Sinai communities, possibly with weapons provided through U.S. military aid, is creating more incentives for Egyptians to join militant groups. By carrying out a campaign of repression and human rights abuses that is unprecedented in the country's modern history, and by closing off all avenues of peaceful expression of dissent through politics, civil society, or media, Al-Sisi is stoking the very fires he says he wants to extinguish." Well, yeah, I certainly couldn't have said it better myself. What's really remarkable about this is the kind of rhetoric you would tend to hear from these neocons about a country they don't like,
right,
like Syria, which is, you know, they've, as I'm sure you your listeners are aware of, this whole project to remake the map of the Middle East dating back to the mid-1990s with supporters of Netanyahu,
sure,
wanting to bump off Iraq, Syria, Iran, et cetera. Well, that's the kind of rhetoric they would use, appealing to human rights. But
right,
to do it against Egypt, that's something that the Netanyahu government is very, very opposed to doing anything that would undermine the military government of Egypt. So this is a very interesting split.
Yep. All right, now hold that thought right there, and that's exactly where we'll pick it up on the other side of this break with Jonathan Marshall at ConsortiumNews.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jonathan Marshall, writing at ConsortiumNews.com. And we're talking about this letter by the Working Group on Egypt that they wrote to John Kerry. It includes Robert toward a neo-Reaganite foreign policy, Kagan, and Elliot, Iran-Contra conviction, and oops, arms to Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Abrams. I'm very clever with the middle name sometimes, you see. And we're talking about how they're telling Kerry to tell the Egyptian dictatorship not to stop being a dictatorship, not to hold free elections and let the Muslim Brotherhood come back to power or anything like that, but at least to back off the internal war against the Muslim Brotherhood and their friends that were thrown out of power because it's counterproductive. You're going to end up creating a real bunch of terrorists to fight by pretending that the Muslim Brotherhood are terrorists, basically. You're digging yourself a hole. And so, hey, Kerry, tell Sisi to knock it off before things get out of control here. So, basically, did I sum that up right? I scanned through this letter here. I didn't see anything about it's not fair to do a military coup d'etat, and so we ought to have free and fair elections here. They're just saying, hey, lighten up on the torture a little bit before you turn Egypt into Syria. We want stability there on Israel's southern border, not madness like on their northern border.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that despite all of our rhetoric, people who run our foreign policy are very ambivalent about elections. As you may remember, when people of Gaza voted the wrong way and elected Hamas into government, the Bush administration suddenly didn't like democracy so much.
Yeah, they had Elliot Abrams funnel a bunch of guns to Fatah that fell into the hands of Hamas. Yeah.
Right. So, I think it was President Wilson or someone who said, we have to teach those people to elect good men and, send in the Marines if they don't. But, nonetheless, I want to give these guys and women credit for saying some very profoundly true things. And Kerry listened a little bit a couple days ago when he was in Egypt holding a press conference. Instead of just saying things are great in Egypt the way he used to, he said, and I quote, obviously there has been a little bit of tension over certain issues. Boy, that's a hard-hitting statement. And he went on to say, of course, we have to support Egyptian security forces fighting terrorists. But then he did say we have to take care, to also recognize that some are trying to seek peaceful change and political dialogue. And if we don't, we just throw them all in jail. We'll just get some more terrorists and we won't be safer. It was an extremely mild rebuke of the government, so mild that I think it basically sent, unfortunately, a message to the government, which is Washington doesn't really mean it. They just sent us 8 F-16 jets, which flew over Cairo in formation, telling everyone in Egypt, hey, the Americans support the military government here. We sent a whole bunch of other arms as well. For Kerry to say in an English language press conference, we have a a little bit of tension with not much of a rebuke. So I was personally quite disappointed. I think we have a long way to go to have a sensible policy in Egypt, as in most of the rest of the Middle East. But I guess he heard something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the clean break policy there, David Wurmser and Richard Perl and the boys, and, you know, obviously Abrams and Kagan are not very far removed from that. It does seem kind of, I guess they have a peace deal with Egypt, but it's not like the Muslim Brotherhood nullified it or anything like that when they got elected. And for that matter, even without a peace deal with Syria, Assad was really no more of a threat up in Syria on their northern border than the Muslim Brotherhood, or for that matter, Mubarak or Sisi, were on their southern border. So why do you think the discrepancy in the policy there, where they'll even support al-Qaeda in order to try to overthrow Assad, but you know, they want such stability in Egypt at any cost, basically?
Yes, and I would point you, I did a long article about a week or two ago for Consortium News on the history of our diplomacy with Assad and how it basically helped create the civil war. It was an absolute disaster that Assad kept reaching out to both Israel and the United States to make a comprehensive peace deal. He was actually negotiating with the Israeli government and had most of the peace deal nailed down, and Bush and Cheney vetoed it, just stomped on the Israelis and told them not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once Netanyahu took power in 2009, bam, he closed it all down. He's, you know, much tougher ideologue. He wants kind of total victory. And, of course, it was his American supporters who wrote that roadmap for remaking the map of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's one that Ron Paul complained about back in the campaign in 2008, that, you know, we don't just support the Israelis in all of their wars, but we intervene and stop them from making peace when they're trying to make peace. I mean, that should have been the scandal of the century right there.
Ironically, the U.S., which is supposed to be, you know, is the world's greatest superpower, ends up constantly doing the bidding of its allies, whether Israel, you know, we sent troops into Lebanon under Reagan, and we've been supporting their wars, you know, all over the place. We also, if you think about what Iraq was all about, we were basically put up to that war by an agent of the Iranian government, Chalabi. And so our policy has never been one to kind of think clearly what American interests are and to pursue them intelligently. It's led to no end of catastrophe in terms of human lives and national treasure. So I give these guys some credit. They're ideologues. As I say, I vehemently disagree with them most of the time. They're usually wanting us to get into more wars, but maybe they've learned something. And so it's not so much that I have new huge moral agreements with them, but anytime these guys can strike a note of realism, I'd say we've made a step forward, because at least they're not in fantasy land of, we can bump off the government of Iraq and be in and out in 60 days and everything will be fine.
Right.
It's that kind of unrealism that is so catastrophic.
Mm. Well, I like to joke sometimes that I'm a reverse truther, and I think that the Republicans and the Democrats, and especially the neoconservatives, have all been working for Osama and Zawahiri all along, playing out their end of the script, exactly what al-Qaeda would have us do in any given situation for the last 14 years or something like that. It sounds like here you have at least Kagan, if not Crystal, you know, scratching his head a minute and saying, well, wait a minute. Do we really have to prove Zawahiri right about us on every occasion? Or, you know, maybe,
yeah,
and again, it's not
so,
like he's saying we should have let the Muslim Brotherhood stay. Although I think he did defend the elections and the results of the elections back in 2011 and 12. Am I wrong about that? That he didn't
know,
he
I,
say
I,
like,
I
hey,
not,
let's wait and see what happens here, guys. Whereas some of, you know, Frank Gaffney and them are screaming to high heavens that it's, you know, the end of the world and stuff.
I can't say for sure, but I will say, you know, a key difference is Crystal is sort of in that, I hesitate to say Israel right or wrong, because a lot of these guys are not just pro-Israel. They're pro one particular wing of Israeli politics. It's a big mistake to think someone is pro or anti-Israel. These guys support, you know, a very hardline Netanyahu first policy. And so, Kagan, in a column last year in the Washington Post, had a remarkable statement where he was distinguishing his own views from those of the Israeli government. And he said, and this is not something you'd hear from Crystal, he said, to Israel, which has never supported democracy anywhere in the Middle East except Israel, the presence of a brutal military dictatorship bent on the extermination of Islamism is not only tolerable but desirable. But he said, in Egypt, U.S. interests and Israel's perceptions of its own interests sharply diverge. If one believes that any hope for moderation in the Arab world requires finding moderate voices, not only among secularists but also among Islamists, America's current strategy in Egypt is producing the opposite result. So,
perfect.
That's very remarkable, you know, independent view of things. Yeah. I give him credit.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan. I sure appreciate your work and your time on the show today.
Thank you very much.
All right, so that's Jonathan Marshall. He's got quite a few really great articles over there at consortiumnews.com. Check him out. This one is Obama's Egypt Policy Breeds Terrorism. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome back.
All right, next up on the show is Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. That is 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Welcome back to the show, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing good. I always love coming on your show because you've got like the best bump music of any show anywhere.
I do have really good bumper music. It's
yeah,
true.
It rocks.
Yeah. Actually, that one belongs to me. Well, it's called Dang Old Bobby, but... It's a friend of mine wrote that just to be theme music on this show.
That's awesome.
But most of it is not, just that one. Anyway, so hey, thanks, and welcome back to the show. Very good to have you here. Thanks for doing what you do and writing the things you write and saying the things you say. I really appreciate it. Six state laws nullifying federal actions in practice go into effect. For immediate release, August 3rd, it says here at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. So let's start with the FDA.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite actions that states have engaged in over the last year or so. And this is one of those things that just kind of blew up this year. We've got these laws that are called right to try laws. And basically what they do is they cut through the FDA bureaucratic red tape by completely ignoring it and create a mechanism within a state where people can access unapproved treatments and medications if they're critically ill or considered to be possibly terminally ill. So as it is now under FDA rules, you have to go through all kinds of bureaucratic red tape. You basically got to get federal permission to try out these drugs that could well save your life. 22 states now have put laws on the books that bypass the FDA. They allow people to access those medications within that state without the FDA approval or the process. And they also provide some shielding for the manufacturers and the doctors that help them, you know, be able to offer these experimental drugs. So, you know, this is a no-brainer. How in the world can you look at somebody in the eye and say, you know what, we're really sorry that you're dying, but, you know, you're going to have to wait 6 months while we approve your application. You know, it's just absurd. And this is one of those things that crosses party lines. And like I said, 22 states have passed these types of law. Three states went into effect on August 1st as Alabama, Minnesota, and North Dakota, if I'm not mistaken off the top of my head. So three more states where you can get treatment if you need it without having to deal with the feds.
And so that counts for people who just say, well, screw this, I'm going to North Dakota or whatever too, right?
As far as I know, it does. You know, I imagine you would probably have to have a doctor there in North Dakota.
Sure.
Maybe you could take your doctor with you. But, yeah, as long as you're within the border of the states, the state laws govern what happens there.
People really need to know about this. And you know what? Again, like you're saying, as far as it being a no-brainer, it's also – it shouldn't be political at all. The only reason it's political is because of the lobbyists of Big Pharma and the power of the national government. But for – any person of any description at all in America, as long as they're adults, this ought to be absolute unanimous consensus. And how dare they stand between people and their last gasp, dying chance at prolonging their life or you know, surviving. It's just crazy to think that that the federal government would dare stand in the way like this. Although, I guess on the other hand, Mike, that, you know, a lot of government school graduates would counter that. Come on, you know, these companies are going to be putting out all kinds of crazy medicines, and there's a FDA for reason to protect us from these terrible, you know, capitalists just selling us poison. They don't care if we die, so we need the government to go through, make them go through the process and double check these drugs and make sure they're safe.
Yeah, it's kind of an absurd article or argument when you break it down, though, because basically people – what they're saying is, you know, we got to protect you and the government's going to protect you, so we're going to let you die while we protect you. You know, that's absurd. And, you know, we have doctors for a reason. Doctors are you know, they're trained. They can weigh the risks and benefits of these various medications. And we're talking about people here who – this is their last chance, you know. And this should be up to the doctor and the individual, not some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. So, you know, this whole idea that we need some guy in a suit and tie sitting at a desk in an office on Capitol Hill to make these decisions for us is just absurd. And, yeah. You know, I think anybody that says that has their head up the wrong place, to be quite blunt.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah, I mean, no matter who you are or where you're from, it's basically just, you know, as you said, kind of beyond argument. And I think, you know, the next step here, you say we got 22 states now have passed laws like this. Well, then that means that we got a lot of millions of Americans who ought to be very jealous of that and very angry at their state representatives for allowing it to be that way, that their state is not one of the states that would allow this. And what are they waiting for? And this ought to be, you know, a no-brainer as an easy political win for any state congressman or state senator anywhere in America that, you know, look at me, I'm a champion of dying old ladies. Who can argue with that?
That's exactly right. And, you know, nobody has. When you look at the vote totals in the various legislatures in these states where this has passed, it's not even been close. In a lot of cases, you're seeing unanimous votes, or you'll see two or three pinheads that vote against it for whatever crazy reason. And this is this is the fastest moving state movement I've ever seen. Most of these things, it takes a while. You know, you look at the drones, and this has been a really good year for drones as well. But that's taken 3 or 4 years to kind of build. You know, it took a couple of states taking that tentative first step, and then it's built from there. This basically started last year with Arizona. They actually passed it on a voter referendum. And once that happened, you know, to see 22 states pass something like this, and there's two other states that have passed it, and they're still waiting for governor's signature. So that's actually 24. Mm. When you see that many states in 1 year, you know, that's pretty significant, and shows just how much of a unanimity we're seeing on this particular issue.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry I don't have a footnote here, but there was a study that came out not long ago where they looked back at drugs that had been approved that turned out it was a big mistake and they were much more dangerous than the FDA thought. And drugs that were denied or withheld for some long period of time, but then it turned out they were okay and could have saved this and that many lives, that the FDA ultimately is more violent than the Pentagon. They actually kill more people than any other government agency, which is really saying something. Department of Transportation, CIA, DOD, but the FDA, they're the most lethal of all.
That's an incredible statistic. And, you know, I'm not, you know, this isn't something that I'm really in-depth nuts and bolts on. I understand this legislation, but it's not something I've really studied. But even from my basic knowledge, I've seen numerous cases, and I've actually known people that have wanted to access treatments that are readily available in Europe and have actually had to get on a plane and go to Europe to access these treatments because the FDA refuses for whatever reason to approve them. So, you know, this is a very real thing. And to deny these people thing, it just boggles my mind. You know, like you said, you're looking at this poor person that's suffering from this disease and you're saying, I don't know. I don't know if you should have this or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's the state for you, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, because it's the incentive structure of the whole thing, right? Anybody in charge of enforcing that against you is not in charge of deciding that that's the rule. And so they all just, you know, for the paycheck, they make their peace very quickly with their job being to say to people, I'm sorry, but that's what the computer says. That's what the rule says. That's the way it has to be. And so, you know, but I'll see you at your funeral, though, and I'll throw a little rose on the ground for you.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you see this on all kinds of different issues. And the you know, this is kind of getting off topic a little bit, but that, you know, gets to this idea of it just drives me crazy when people are so, well, we've got to respect their authority. You know, we've got to respect the process and the system. Well, the process and system sucks. So, you know, maybe it's time that we start breaking that down a little bit. And that's the neat thing about doing these things through your state governments. It gives you a little bit of power to face down that power. So you're not standing there as a single individual trying to beat your head against this this massive marble wall.
Yeah, give you some respectability as you disrespect.
That's exactly.
Good. All right, now hold it right there, everybody, because when we get back, we're going to talk with Mike Meharry about other ways the government is screwing you, the national government, that is, and other ways that the 10th Amendment Center is working to use the power of the state governments to nullify and interpose themselves between the people and the national government. One sec.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. It's me, Scott. I'm doing my radio show. I got Mike Meharry on the line. He's from the 10th Amendment Center. And now we spent the whole first segment on the states interposing themselves between the people and the national government. 22 of them, 24 if you count the two, just waiting on a governor's signature to allow people to take medicine if they want to, whether it's approved by the FDA or not, assuming they're in real dire straits anyway. So that's going on. But now we have quite a few topics to tackle in this next segment here. And I'll just name them and then turn it over to you. We got 10 minutes to go. So first of all, hemp. National government says no hemp. State government say go ahead. And then, ooh, the license plate trackers. Very interesting news out of Montana there. And then I wanted to end with, it's not in this press release, but I wanted to, at the end of the interview, if we could, get to the latest progress in the Off Now campaign to nullify the NSA. So, Mike, first of all, tell us about the progress in nullifying the federal hemp laws.
Another one to me that's a no-brainer. And, yeah, especially I live in Kentucky, and Kentucky used to be the number one state in the country in growing hemp. It's a product that has like 25,000 uses, everything from biofuel to panels for automobiles to food, you know, just so many things you can do with this plant. And yet the federal government says, no, can't grow it because it looks a little bit like marijuana. So we're starting to see a number of states that are saying, you know what, state government or federal government, you go ahead and try to enforce your ban on hemp. We're going to let people grow it in our state and go ahead and create a market for this plant. In North Dakota, their hemp law went into effect on Saturday, and they joined 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other states that are allowing hemp production. And what this does, it doesn't stop the federal government from enforcing its hemp ban, but the ugly truth is, as far as the federal government goes, is they don't have the resources or the manpower to go into these states and stop farmers from growing this plant. And every state where we've seen the states take down their barriers to growing hemp, we've seen people start growing hemp. There's been actual crops that have been harvested in Colorado and in Vermont and in some of these other states. And what I guarantee you we're going to see is we're going to see these states, they're going to begin developing these markets. People are going to begin manufacturing the various products with them. And other states are going to look and say, hey, look what North Dakota's doing. Look what Tennessee's doing. Look what South Carolina's doing. They're over here and they're growing this plant and making these products. And, you know, we should join them. And I guarantee you within 5 years, the federal hemp ban, even if it's still on the books, is not going to exist in practice. And that's a good thing because this is something that these farmers need. You know, like I said, I'm here in Kentucky and the crackdown on tobacco has just devastated the agricultural industry in this state. Hemp would be a perfect thing to fill that void. It grows anywhere. And
pot is already the largest cash crop in Kentucky, so you might as well grow hemp.
Well, absolutely. And that's another thing that's been essentially nullified. You know, the federal government continues to insist that it's going to ban marijuana. And now we have more than 20 states with medical marijuana legalized. And then we've got good old Colorado and Washington and Alaska that are allowing it for recreational use, and maybe Oregon too. This is great. The federal government should not be dictating these things to the people of the state. People in Colorado want legalized marijuana. Who is some dude in D.C. to say they can't?
And you know what? If logging and chemical interests can get hemp banned way back in the 30s and all that under President for Life Roosevelt and all that, there are a lot more wide and varied special interests who could profit and benefit from industrial hemp. I mean, you talk about farmers. I don't even think of some old man in a straw hat. I just think of Archer Daniels Midland and Monsanto. And just think of all the billions of dollars they could be making. The thousands of dollars it would take for them to spend on lobbying in order to make millions and even billions on the trade, the open market trade in industrial hemp products. So that's who you need to get on board right there, and you're done, really.
Absolutely. So that's another law that went into effect on Saturday. And then let's talk about spying for just a minute while we close out. Also in North Dakota and I believe Minnesota is where the license plate reader law passed and went into effect. And then North Dakota, a law restricting drone surveillance went into effect. And these don't directly impact the federal government. You may say, hey, what difference does it make to the federal government whether or not North Dakota allows drone surveillance? Well, the fact of the matter is with both the drones and these license plate readers, the federal government funds them at the state level, and then they tap into the information that they gather. And you got these huge databases that the DEA and all of these other alphabet agencies in D.C. are creating using data that's gathered by the states – using the equipment that the federal government's paying for. So if you want to attack the surveillance state, you've got to also attack what's going on at your state and local level. So every state that limits the use of drones and that limits the use of these license plate readers, that limits the amount of information that's available for the federal government to tap in and track you all around the country. So
right. And that ought to really offend people's sensibilities too. Like out of all the Snowden revelations, the one that they're keeping all of our cell phone location data forever. In other words, tracking every living room we've been in, every car we've ridden in, and who else was in it too, you know, for years going back. I mean, this is the ultimate violation of privacy. The license plate readers along the very same lines. highly Absolutely. Objectionable, should be to anyone.
Absolutely. And, you know, a website, one of the techie websites, I can't remember off the top of my head which one it was, but they actually did an experiment where they tracked this guy's cell phone. He let them do it, you know, and they went in and got all of his location. You could tell so much about this guy's life, you know, what political interest he has, where he goes to church, whether or not he's on medication. So many things that you can deduce just from knowing where people go. Absolutely. You want to talk about violation of privacy, and the federal government is taking this stuff and just storing it away forever. So by limiting it at the state level, by saying, you know what? We're only going to allow it to be collected with a warrant. You're not allowed to store it. By putting any limits at all, you're keeping that out of the hands of the federal surveillance state. And it's an indirect way to attack something that's going on at the federal level. And like I said earlier when we were talking, the limits on drones has really grown. We've seen a lot of states finally say, you know what, we've got to do something about this drone surveillance. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to have – like the dude in Kentucky just shot the one down that was over his house.
Right.
Which, you know, it's another solution.
Yep. Well, you know, a couple of missing children stories and that kind of thing, and they'll just have predators and reapers over every major city in America for too long. Then again, like you say, regular folk, actual people, other than just special interest groups, actual people have, you know, can have a lot more effect at the state level. I think you guys are proving that all the time. Than you know, most of us on the outs of the political class would possibly imagine. So, you know, real progress, as you're saying, is being made. I don't mean to sound like such a downer. And I'm keeping you into the break here, but I got to get at least 1 minute from you, if I could, please, about the off now and progress in the campaign against the National Security Agency.
Well, you know, like I said, part of what we're doing at off now does involve these local initiatives, and that's where we've seen the most success. We had two of the off now bills that would actually limit the resources to the NSA itself, make it out of at least one house at a state level. That was in Maine and in Montana this year. And then we had, I think, 15 bills that were introduced that either made it out of committees or that didn't make it through a house or didn't even make it out of committee. So, you know, some people might look at that and be discouraged. I'm encouraged. Simply by the fact that, hey, who would have ever thought, you know what, we're going to have a movement where we're going to turn off resources to NSA. And we're not going to give up. We're going to keep pressing it. We're going to keep pressing it in Utah. We're looking at some things that we can actually do at the local level in Bluffdale, Utah, as a way to get around some of the resistance that we're finding at the state level. There are ways for people to engage against these things. We have to be creative and we have to be persistent with it, because I tell you what, we have learned without a doubt the powers that be, the law enforcement lobbies, all of these people, whenever we try to do this, they're going to come out strong against us. So we need people to support this movement. We need people to keep bugging and pestering their state lawmakers and saying, we want to limit the surveillance state by taking action at our state level. And you can do that over at offnow.org. Just head over there. There's some ways you can join and get involved and we can beat back this surveillance state.
Awesome. All right, everybody. That's Mike Meharry. You can tell why he is communications director at the 10th Amendment Center. That's 10thamendmentcenter.com and offnow.org. Thanks very much for your time again, Mike. Good talk to you.
Thanks for having me always, man.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Waleed Farwana.
He writes at this great blog, lateempire.com, lateempire.com, and you might remember I talked to him, I think, right about a year ago, maybe almost a year ago, about the rise of the Islamic State and this great long think piece that he had done for antiwar.com about it. This one is called God's Revolution in three parts, and it's about the rise of Hezbollah. People are always telling me I pronounce it wrong. Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Waleed?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back on, Scott.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here, and I appreciate you doing this work. And I guess I'm a little bit hesitant to talk too much about this just because everybody's piling on against Iran and all their allies in order to try to ruin the Iran deal. And I'm sure not for that, but whatever, the truth is the truth, and I'm interested in it. And it's something that, as we talked about in the emails, I think as you put it, we hardly ever hear anyone talk about Hezbollah that doesn't have a dog in the fight and a propaganda war to wage to make one point or another. And so it's really nice to see, you know, a kind of objective look at just what is Hezbollah, what is their, or however the hell you say it, what exactly is their relationship with the Iranians, and what does it all mean, and all of that. So, cool. I appreciate that you wrote it, and I appreciate you joining us on the show. So, I guess, do we need to start with the 79 revolution in Iran? Is that it?
I mean, yeah, you could start there if you really want to get a grasp for what Hezbollah is all about. Really what the 79 revolution and really what the 1983 founding of Hezbollah were kind of the two different geographical locations where the same ideology sprang up. And I mean, just to add to what you had just said about people having a dog in this fight with regards to Hezbollah and that really coloring their perceptions of the organization. I mean, yeah, that's true. And there's always going to be, you know, hypocrisy by people with an agenda who will look at Hezbollah, call it an Iranian proxy, call it a terrorist organization, and then just assume that that's all you need to know about the organization that itself. But that's really just not true. I mean, there are a number of pretexts that led up to the foundation of Hezbollah, a lot of injustices on the part of the Lebanese government, which marginalized the people who eventually became Hezbollah, and as well as the Iranians who underwent, you know, years of suffering by colonial powers, by their own leaders who were backed by colonial powers, particularly the Shah of Iran. But yeah, if you really wanted to, and sorry to switch topics so fast, but if you really do want to get back to the 1979 revolution, what you saw there was a rise to power, essentially, of a new kind of government on the world stage, which really hadn't even been seen since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, which was it's pronounced the Velayat al-Faqih. And it's a kind of religious, it's just a kind of theocracy where a cleric essentially runs the show. He is the ultimate authority, and he is the person from which law descends, and he is seen as the sole arbiter and greatest judge that people are to follow. And obviously there are a ring of courts around him and whatnot, and a lot of other institutions and apparatuses. And it's much more complex than simply looking at the spiritual leader and saying that's the guy who runs everything. But it was kind of unique in that it was really the first purely Islamic government that had been seen in quite a long time. And it sent a lot of shockwaves throughout the region, particularly because the people who were allied and the people who were followers of the spiritual leader who brought the Islamic revolution to Iran, which was Ayatollah Khomeini, and I'm sure his name is pretty familiar to many of your listeners, his following was so ideological and so radical and really so willing to sacrifice on the battlefield for the sake of this ideology that they really sent shockwaves throughout the region. These are the people who, you might have heard of this before, these are the people who were willing to send human waves into minefields and who were willing to run into machine gun fire on the enemy's side just to overwhelm a position. And so really this kind of revolutionary fervor coupled with extremely anti-Western rhetoric, really scared a lot of people, particularly in the West. And it really led to this whole set of circumstances where you see sanctions and isolation and invasions occurring all around Iran that, you know, persist to this day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, meanwhile, the Shia of southern Lebanon are just living in poverty, but minding their own business, huh?
To a significant extent. And, you know, I hate to say that they're just minding their own business, because I don't think anybody ever really does mind their own business. But they are essentially a marginalized group, and they are just marginalized by successive regimes, from the Ottomans to the French. Even with regards to the Lebanese government itself, they kind of occupied like this second class position within the Lebanese society. And this kind of started to change around the late 1970s, where you had a cleric, Iranian-born cleric named Musa al-Sadr. And I don't really know if he's related to Muqtada al-Sadr over in Iraq, but probably the same family line. But he kind of rallied this Lebanese Shia base into political action. And then this was kind of like the genesis of Lebanese Shia political action, which started in the 70s. So yeah, just to answer your question, they were pretty marginalized. And
so minding their own business in a de facto sense. They didn't have a choice, because they didn't have any power over anyone else at that point. But now, so this pretty guy, Sadr, you're saying, this, am I right, this was the foundation of the Amal movement then?
Right. So he started a movement called the Amal movement, which was a secular socialist movement, which was mostly for the Shia. And it was mostly about kind of trying to get Shia to participate in politics, really just to end their marginalization. They were kind of like this, you know, very agrarian, viewed as backwards type of people. And what Sadr's mission essentially was to bring to them a greater sense of civility, more power. And his activity ensued up until about 1978, 1979, when he was kidnapped on a trip to Libya, and he just simply disappeared. Nobody ever heard from him again, which was one of the more odd conspiracies of the 1970s, which, like, nobody knows what happened to this extremely charismatic world leader. Obviously, he was probably, you know, captured or imprisoned or something like that. Mm. But his departure, to put it mildly, was really one of the power vacuums which the Iranians would eventually fill with Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, pardon me, but you don't mind me asking, you're not cleaning your garage while we're talking here, right?
No, absolutely not. Somebody just rolled by, unfortunately.
Oh, I see. Yeah. A little bit of background noise there.
Yeah,
no problem. All right. So now you got to explain about the PLO in Lebanon. What's the PLO doing in Lebanon?
So the PLO was in Lebanon after PLO was established essentially as the name sounds. It's called the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and it was this collection of militias which were dedicated to the goal of defeating the Israeli military and reclaiming Palestine for the Palestinians. And their odyssey, which took them out of Palestine to Jordan. And these militias essentially established a state within a state in Jordan. This obviously led to extreme conflict with the ruling Jordanian regime, who then expelled the PLO, and the PLO went to Lebanon. And the reason why they went to Lebanon was because Lebanon was this traditionally had this very weak state, and it was easy to get the Lebanese government to acquiesce towards allowing this PLO. And this really, you know, I think it was upwards of 100,000 militiamen to essentially enter this small Lebanese country of 3 million. And this really tipped the balance of sectarian power in Lebanon, which is a country, Lebanon is a country which is extremely sensitive towards sectarianism, because it's 30% Catholic, about 30% Shia Muslim, 20% Sunni Muslim, and the rest are you know, separated factions of other religious sects. So when you put in 100,000 armed Sunni Muslims for the most part in the form of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in a very sensitive sectarian climate, you're going to get a challenge from some of the other sects. And the main sect that challenged the PLO were the Catholics, and they were the Lebanese Falange. And for all intents and purposes, they were this sort of created in the same vein as the European fascists, drew a lot of inspiration from the Spanish fascists. And they really started having extremely violent episodes with the PLO around 1975. And in the meantime, the PLO was also attacking Israel from the southern part of Lebanon into northern Israel, which was understandably on the Israelis' end, I suppose, something that had to be stopped in order for them to carry on with a sort of civilized life in Israel. And this led to a couple of invasions, which I'll let you ask a few questions before I get into that.
Yeah, well, so yeah, that's the thing. Now, I guess the invasion comes in 1982. The Israelis make their alliance with the Falange, and or I don't know exactly at what point they do. They come in and invade. But so what do the Shia care? It's not really their fight. Why wouldn't they, or did they just stand back, or why wouldn't they just kind of stand back, let the Israelis kick the PLO out of there? Because, you know, obviously, as you said, it's 100,000 Sunni fighters. Why would the Shia population, you know, be on their side? So sort of like when America invaded Iraq, at least at first, all the Shia stood back and said, yeah, thanks, go ahead and get rid of Saddam for us, kind of thing. So did that happen to any degree in this case? Or if not, why not?
Well, so it's a very complicated answer because, yes, for the most part, Shia Muslims were extremely happy about the Israeli invasion because many of them, they hated the PLO. The PLO was corrupt in many ways, just as these militia organizations tend to be. And they were really, you know, they were guilty of exploiting Shia to a considerable extent in southern Lebanon. So there was a great deal of jubilation in southern Lebanon when Israel invaded. But the Israelis, they kind of messed up with regards to their positioning towards the Shia population because because there's also a significant number of Catholics who live in South Lebanon, the Israelis really just prioritized the Catholic allies over the Shia, completely ignored the Shia's wishes and whims and whatever. And this led to a conflict between the Israelis and the Shia. There's also an ideological element to the adversarial nature of the Shia towards the Israelis, because the Shia are still Muslims, and really Israel is viewed in much of the Middle East as this grand enemy of Islam in general, particularly because of their occupation or their control or their domination, whatever you want to call it, of Jerusalem. And this is seen as a blight upon the fabric of Islamic society, really, that they're one of their holiest sites is dominated by a completely different religion. And so there was a mix of, yes, we're happy that you removed the PLO, but we're not happy with who did it. And so, I mean, you can kind of compare it to Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq. Now, I'm sure he was happy that the United States removed Saddam because Saddam killed his dad and his family. But at the same time, he wasn't really happy with the United States presence in Iraq either. So, yeah, just to answer your question, that's the long answer.
Yeah, no, I got you. I mean, it makes perfect sense. It's a simple matter of nationalism, Arab nationalism or Lebanese or neighborhood nationalism anyway. This is our town, and what the hell are you doing here?
Exactly.
And yeah, I don't think I've ever heard rumors that the Israelis treated the Shia with the slightest bit of respect, you know, if they happen to be in the way of what they were doing against the PLO, et cetera. So then is it just as simple as that? Thus was born the Party of God?
Not just as simple as that. So around the 1982 invasion, now we're going back to Iran here. Now, Iran, obviously, very ideological government. And as soon as the Israelis invaded, Ayatollah Khomeini was already calling for the dispatch of thousands of Iranian Revolutionary Guards to Lebanon. Now, at this time, they had created an alliance with Syria, and Syria is really the gatekeeper to Lebanon. You can't really go, you can't really control Lebanon, you can't really operate in Lebanon without Syria's permission, or you couldn't at that point in time. And so the Iranians and the Syrians had an alliance, and the alliance was essentially, the alliance was basically based on the fact that they were both isolated states, and they both hated Saddam Hussein. So they, their deal essentially was the Iranians would provide the Syrians with very cheap oil, and in return, the Syrians would give the Iranians a pretty sizable influence in Lebanon. So at the outset of this invasion, the IRGC, which is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, for people who are unfamiliar, they dispatched about 2,000 guys to eastern Lebanon in a place called the Bekaa Valley. And in this valley, they started to train these favored Lebanese clans in that region. They started to give them military training, kind of religious education or indoctrination, whatever you want to call it. And this, from this activity, this is where Hezbollah was essentially born, was from this IRGC activity. So that's what led to the creation of Hezbollah. It was like this clandestine network at first, started by the IRGC, which later grew much more popular as time went on.
And now, so how long did the PLO last? The Israelis came in, kicked them out. They fled to Libya at some point, but the Israelis stayed anyway?
Right. So the Israelis stayed in southern Lebanon up to, and they occupied a pretty significant portion of Lebanon. The thing is, though, the Israelis are, at that point in time at least, I don't know if they are now, but they simply were not good at occupying cities. They couldn't, they didn't have the constitution for it. Their population could not handle the casualties. And so, really what you saw was they would withdraw from all the cities and then they would give them to militias. Whether they were Christian militias or Shia militias or whatever. Because they had some Shia who were actually allied with the Israelis, and they would work with those Shias in order to occupy towns. So really what you had was the Israelis would ring around the countryside with their armor and their air cavalry or whatever, and militias would occupy the towns. Now what happened was around 1983, 1984, 1985, Hezbollah at this time was mounting an offensive against Israel, and they managed to push them back to a 5-mile strip around the Israeli-Lebanese border. So a series of events ensued, which led to a partial Israeli pullout to this 5-mile strip. And then from 1985 until the year 2000, really, the Israelis and Hezbollah were fighting over this 5-mile wide strip for the better part of 15 years.
And now, man, that's interesting. I guess I never really realized, at least back then, that it was, you know, that much of a kind of Germany and France, Western Front, World War II kind of, or World War I, I mean to say, kind of thing, fighting over that little territory. And then, so, at what point then was the Hezbollah suicide bomber invented as a tactic for use against the Israeli occupation?
Right. So, yeah, as you just said, like Hezbollah were really one of the pioneers, if not the pioneer, of strategic suicide bombing. And they had one episode, which was essentially an Israeli catastrophe, where they placed a suicide bomber outside of an Israeli military headquarters in this Lebanese town called Tyre, which is spelled T-Y-R-E. And, Hezbollah bomber detonated himself, and he killed well over 100 Israelis. And this was for a country which is extremely sensitive towards its military casualties, this was a complete catastrophe for them. I mean, just to give you a comparison, in the 3-week war with Hezbollah in 2006, the Israelis lost 136 men. And this was enough for them to get them to sue for peace in a ceasefire, losing over 100 troops in a single bombing, really motivated them to to go to this 5-mile strip where they weren't really open or vulnerable to this type of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And Hezbollah really did employ the strategy of suicide bombing throughout even that war between 1985 and 2000 to a significant effect. Now, Hezbollah no longer really uses suicide bombers. I haven't even heard of a single instance of them using a suicide bomber since the year 2000. I think it's kind of fallen out of style, essentially.
Well, since the occupation ended, yeah.
Yeah, and you didn't really even see them use it in 2006. You haven't seen them use the tactic in the Syrian war. But they were really known for this tactic of suicide bombing, and it really extends from the Iranian Revolution that we talked about, where you had IRGC members who were willing to run into minefields, who were willing to run at enemy machine gun fire, and really this kind of ideological fervor spread from Iran to Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
where you saw these grand acts of self-sacrifice against the enemy.
All right, now... Well, geez, there's so many different things to go over here. I'm not sure exactly where to start. I guess, can you tell us about the Sabra and Shatila massacres, and not just because of the sensational nature of what happened, that kind of thing, but, to kind of explain the role or the relationships and the different groups fighting here? Because it seems like this whole thing really is the perfect example of blowback where, Israel sort of kind of at least created Hamas deliberately. But their creation of Hezbollah just seems to be, from the moment that they start fighting or, start picking on the Shia of southern Lebanon, they at least, as you said, had some help from the IRGC on the other side. But they basically create this group born just to resist them. And then they fight this low-level war against them for 15 years or, 20 years or something, and they seem to only just make this group stronger and stronger the whole time.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple of issues there. I mean, we can talk about the Sabra Shatila massacre, and that kind of goes back to the whole idea where Israelis don't want to occupy cities, again, because it exposes their troops to simply too much enemy gunfire. I mean, I can give you a quick anecdote, and I mean, this is just a urban legend. I don't know if it ever actually happened, but really what really made the Israelis pull out of Beirut and cede control to these allied militias, particularly the Falange, was there was an Israeli officer who was in a Lebanese restaurant, and they had just essentially conquered Beirut, and they were extremely arrogant. And this Israeli officer he was trying to buy a shawarma sandwich in a restaurant with his Israeli shekels. And just a man standing right next to him in line just pulled out a gun and shot him in the head. And this essentially made the Israelis realize that there is simply no way that we can hold down this city. And so that began a general pullout. I'm not saying that specific instance which motivated an Israeli pullout, but I mean, it goes to show you that there's really no way that you can occupy such a huge city with a relatively small force. And the Sabra Shatila massacre was kind of like this betrayal of UN terms. So the PLO said, okay, we'll pull out of these refugee camps in southern Beirut, but don't harm the population. We'll have UNIFIL move in, and they will take control of the camp. But obviously this didn't happen. The Israelis allowed Christian militias, the Falangists, to flood in to this vacated military force area. And then those militias proceeded to begin this slaughter, really, of thousands of refugees inside of this camp. The purpose or the political purpose of this massacre was essentially to trigger an exodus of Palestinians from Lebanon. They were hoping that if we are savage enough, we can get the rest of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees to leave the country to Syria or something like that. This didn't happen. And, it did end up with some blowback to the Christian militias and to the Israelis as well, in that it really just strengthened the fervor with which their enemies, they were willing to fight them. And so that's what happened with the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Now, the other issue you brought up was how, essentially Israel's activity creates enemies. And that's kind of like the problem with these power vacuums that you see springing up all over the place. You could see them in Iraq. You saw it in Lebanon. Even in the Iranian Revolution, there was a power vacuum. And the issue with the power vacuum is that you simply don't know what you're going to get out of such circumstances.
Yeah, it seems like they're so ham-handed about it, too. Like in 05, they said, the Syrian army must get out of southern Lebanon. Well, come on. Forget calculus. I mean, it's simple math. That Hezbollah is going to become more powerful then, if that's really what you want.
Yeah, and the Syrians, they wanted, they were actually kind of happy for Hezbollah to be there, because it placed between the Syrians and the Israelis. I'll just start over with talking about why Syria was happy for having Hezbollah there.
Sure.
Let me know when I can start. Okay. Yeah, so Syria was, they were pretty happy that Hezbollah was there. Now, it provided, I'm not saying that it was all great for the Syrians. I mean, the Hezbollah was a sort of a challenge to their authority, and they did come to blows a couple of times, but never in a very serious fashion. But for the most part, Syria was happy to have Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, because it placed between the Syrians and the Israelis a bulwark of sorts, which would prevent a direct military confrontation between the Syrian regime and Israel. So, there's obviously a huge power disparity, and it was especially even more pronounced at that time between the Syrians and the Israelis. Syrians did not want a direct confrontation with Israel, and so they kind of used Hezbollah as this guerrilla force to keep them at bay.
Yep. All right, now, so there's way too much to go over here. I mean, we're going to basically just have to skip the war of July and August 06 here, because we're already over time. But let me ask you two last things here real quick. If you could address the Litani River and its importance to Israel and how much you think it has to do with their occupation of Lebanon all that time and you know, their future plans for Lebanon. Is it, how much does that play into it, I guess, first of all, and then I'll save my next one for a minute.
Sure. So, I mean, any water source in the Middle East is extremely valuable. So Lebanon is really known. Well, Lebanon is really the only country in the Middle East that doesn't even have a desert. And it's essentially like this very fertile and lush area, part of the Middle East. So the Litani River is awesome for whoever controls it for two reasons. One, it's a natural geographic defense. And two, it's a water source, fresh water source, which, you know, can be bottled up and distributed and used for irrigation and crops and the population and all that. So those are really that's the strategic importance of the Litani River. I mean, in a very water starved and thirsty region, it's extremely important that you have a water source. And then, you know, number two, it's the general military and strategic defense.
And then now, do you know about, I mean, have the Israelis talked much about how, boy, we sure would like to own that thing forever, and that's why we're doing this, and that kind of deal? Is it that blatant or not?
Well, I don't know if it's that blatant. I haven't really read.
Oh, no, I'm losing you again.
Like that for political purposes.
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a minute. Can you start that answer over?
Or they would have tried to keep it. Had they been allowed to after their 1982 invasion. And really the goal of every successive Israeli invasion, even in the 2006 invasion, was for the Israeli army. Looks like we dropped off again.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know what's...
It's all right. We'll try to wrap up here. Just forget that the last follow up there. You already answered that question. Let me just ask one more thing here at the end, and then I'll let you go.
Sure.
Now you also say in here a couple things that, well, on their surface sound like maybe they're a bit contradictory, where you say, you kind of warn against underestimating, I guess, the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah. And you basically equate southern Lebanon to a province in the Iranian Revolutionary Islamic Republic here. But at the same time, you say they have a lot of autonomy. And it wouldn't be a correct characterization to say that they're just a proxy of Iran. So on one hand, you're saying the relationship is...
Hello?
Hey. Did your internet go out on us or what?
I have no idea what's going on here. It says I have pretty stable internet connection, but it seems like I keep dropping off every 5 seconds.
Oh, well. All right, I'm sorry. Let me just wrap that question up real quick, and then we'll call this thing off. So on one hand, you're saying that the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran is a lot stronger than you think, but don't overstate it. So help parse that for me.
Yeah, so really what that... The kind of that argument's kind of like I'm looking at an Aristotelian mean almost. So it's, yes, they are essentially, and this is, I guess you could say this is my opinion, and I think many people would agree, honestly, that Hezbollah, South Lebanon, an area it controls, is for all intents and purposes a province of Iran. And given the fact that they have such a close alliance that Iran is willing to make this foreign territory, a province of Iran, it also tells you that they have a great deal of trust in the organization itself. Compare a more adversarial alliance, you could say, between the United States and the Iraqi Shia, for example. I don't think that in a million years that the United States would make southern Iraq, for example, a province almost in the same vein as the way that the United States and the Israeli relationship is.
To the United States, the Iranians might.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that is completely true. And they're working on it. They are definitely working on it. So that's kind of what I mean. Like, yeah. If you look at the Israeli and American relationship, America is willing to go as far as to share, you know, the F-35 with the Israelis. That's how much they trust them. But you would never see such a thing with the United States and maybe the Saudis, or the United States and the Iraqis, for example. And that's kind of what I meant by there is this high level of trust, which gives them a considerable degree of autonomy. They trust Hezbollah not to, you know, engage in petty conflicts, not to drag Iran into a, you know, a war that it can't win, not to do anything too stupid, essentially. So, yeah, that's kind of what I meant by that. What I meant by that, yeah.
All right, well, listen, man, I really appreciate you writing this up and your time on the show talking about it. I learned a lot.
Awesome, thanks. Glad to be on. Really hope your listeners learn something from this. And, if you want to check out more of my work, you can check it out at lateempire.com, lateempire.com. And thanks. Thank you so much for having me on, Scott.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate it very much, Waleed. That's Waleed Farwana, everybody. Again, lateempire.com for this 3-part series, God's Revolution, about the creation and rise of Hezbollah. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.